He laughed, and said that he would write it out in his own blood, if your grace would send your little scribe to show him how to make the letters.
Blood, said Danny, horrified. Is that a jape? No, no, don't tell me. I must see him for myself.
She was a young girl and alone, and young girls can change their minds.
Convene my captains and commanders. Hisdar, I know you will forgive me.
Merian must come first, Hisdar smiled genially. We will have other knights, 1,000 knights.
Sir Barristan will show you out.
Danny hurried off, calling for her handmaids. She would not welcome her captain home in a tokar. In the end she tried 12 gowns before she found one she liked, but she refused the crown the Jiqui offered her. As Dario Naharis took a knee before her, Danny's heart gave a lurch. His head was matted with dried blood, and on his temple a deep cut glistened red and raw. His right sleeve was bloody almost to the elbow.
"You're hurt," she gasped. "This,"
Dario touched his temple.
"A crossbowman tried to put a quarrel through me eye, but I outrode it. I was hurrying home to my queen to bask in the warmth of her smile."
He shook his sleeve, spattering red droplets. "This blood is not mine. One of my sergeants said we should go over to the Yunkai, so I reached down his throat and pulled his heart out. I meant to bring it to you as a gift for my silver queen, but 4 of the cats cut me off and came snarling and spitting after me. One almost caught me, so I threw the heart into his face."
"Very gallant," said Sir Barristan, in a tone that suggested it was anything but. "But do you have tidings for her grace?"
"Hard tidings, Sir Grandfather. Astapor is gone, and the slavers are coming north in strength."
"This is old news and stale," growled the shavepate.
"Your mother said the same of your father's kisses," Dario replied. "Sweet queen, I would have been here sooner, but the hills are aswarm with Yunkish sellswords. 4 free companies. Your storm crows had to cut their way through all of them. There is more and worse. The Yunkai are marching their host up the coast route, joined by 4 legions out of Nugis. They have elephants, 100, armored and towered, Talossi slingers too, and a corps of Carthian camelry. 2 more Gascari legions took ship at Astapor. If our captives told it true, they will be landed beyond the Skahazadan to cut us off from the Dothraki Sea."
As he told his tale, from time to time a drop of bright red blood would patter against the marble floor, and Danny would wince.
"How many men were killed?"
she asked when he was done.
"Of ours? Oh, I did not stop to count. We gained more than we lost, though."
"More turncloaks?"
"More brave men drawn to your noble cause. My queen will like them. One is an axeman from the Basilisk Isles, a brute bigger than Belwas. You should see him. Some Westerosi too, 10 or more. Deserters from the Windblown, unhappy with the Yunkai. They'll make good storm crows."
"If you say,"
Danny would not quibble, "Merian might soon have need of every sword."
Sir Barristan frowned at Dario. "Captain, you made mention of 4 free companies. We know of only 3, the Windblown, the Long Lancers, and the Company of the Cat."
"Sir Grandfather knows how to count. The 2nd sons have gone over to the Yunkai."
Dario turned his head and spat.
"That's for Brown Ben Plum. When next I see his ugly face, I will open him from throat to groin and rip out his black heart."
Danny tried to speak and found no words. She remembered Ben's face the last time she had seen it.
"It was a warm face, a face I trusted."
Dark skin and white hair, the broken nose, the wrinkles at the corners of his eyes. Even the dragons had been fond of old Brown Ben, who liked to boast that he had a drop of dragon blood himself.
"3 treasons, will you know. once for gold, and once for blood, and once for love. Was Plum the third treason, or the second? And what did that make Sir Jorah, her gruff old bear? Would she never have a friend that she could trust? What good are prophecies if he cannot make sense of them? If I marry Histar before the sun comes up, will all these armies melt away like morning dew and let me rule in peace?
Dario's announcement had sparked an uproar. Rezdak was wailing. The Shavepate was muttering darkly. Her blood riders were swearing vengeance. Strong Belwas thumped his scarred belly with his fist and swore to eat Bronn Ben's heart with plums and onions. "Please," Danny said, but only Miss Sandy seemed to hear. The queen got to her feet.
"Be quiet! I have heard enough."
"Your grace," Sir Barristan went to one knee, "we are yours to command. What would you have us do?"
"Continue as we planned. Gather food as much as you can."
"If I look back, I'm lost."
"We must close the gates and put every fighting man upon the walls. No one enters, no one leaves."
The hall was quiet for a moment. The men looked at one another. Then Resnick said, "What of the Astapori?" She wanted to scream, to gnash her teeth and tear her clothes and beat upon the floor. Instead, she said,
"Close the gates. Will you make me say it thrice?"
They were her children, but she could not help them now.
"Leave me. Dario remained. That cot should be washed. And I have more questions for you."
The others bowed and went. Danny took Dario Naharis up the steps to her bedchamber, where Iri washed his cut with vinegar and Jiqui wrapped it in white linen. When that was done, she sent her handmaids off as well.
"Your clothes are stained with blood," she told Dario. "Take them off."
"Only if you do the same." He kissed her. His hair smelled of blood and smoke and horse, and his mouth was hard and hot on hers. Danny trembled in his arms. When they broke apart, she said,
"I thought you would be the one to betray me. Once for blood, and once for gold, and once for love," the warlock said. I never thought Brown Ben. Even my dragon seemed to trust him."
She clutched her captain by the shoulders.
"Promise me that you will never turn against me. I could not bear that. Promise me."
"Never, my love." She believed him.
"I swore that I should wed Histar Zolorek if he gave me 90 days of peace. But now, I wanted you from the first time that I saw you. But you were a sellsword, fickle, treacherous. You boasted that you'd had 100 women. 100?
Dario chuckled through his purple beard.
"I lied, sweet queen.
It was 1,000, but never once a dragon." She raised her lips to his.
"What are you waiting for?"
Davos. Lord Alistair looked up sharply. "Voices," he said. "Do you hear, Davos? Someone is coming for us."
"Lamprey," said Davos. "It's time for our supper, or near enough."
Last night Lamprey had brought them half a beef and bacon pie, and a flagon of mead as well. Just the thought of it made his belly start to rumble.
"No, there's more than one."
"He's right."
Davos heard 2 voices at least, and footsteps, growing louder. He got to his feet and moved to the bars. Lord Alistair brushed a straw from his clothes.
"The king has sent for me, or the queen, yes. Selyse would never let me rot here, her own blood."
Outside the cell, Lamprey appeared with a ring of keys in hand. Sir Axel Florent and 4 guardsmen followed close behind him. They waited beneath the torch while Lamprey searched for the correct key.
"Axel," Lord Alistair said, "guards be good. Is it the king who sends for me, or the queen?"
"No one has sent for you, traitor," Sir Axel said.
Lord Alistair recoiled as if he had been slapped.
"No, I swear to you, I committed no treason." Why won't you listen? If His Grace would only let me explain.
Lamprey thrust a great iron key into the lock, turned it, and pulled open the sill. The rusty hinges screamed in protest.
You,
he said to Davis,
come.
Where?
Davis looked to Sir Axel.
Tell me true, sir. Do you mean to burn me?
You are sent for. Can you walk?
I can walk.
Davis stepped from his cell. Lord Alistair gave a cry of dismay as Lamprey slammed the door shut once more.
Take the torch,
Sir Axel commanded the jailer.
Leave the traitor to the darkness.
No, his brother said. Axel, please, don't take the light. Gods have mercy.
Gods? There is only R'hllor and the other.
Sir Axel gestured sharply, and one of his guardsmen pulled the torch from its sconce and led the way to the stair.
Are you taking me to Melisande?
Davis asked.
She will be there,
Sir Axel said.
She is never far from the king, but it is His Grace himself who asks for you.
Davis lifted his hand to his chest, where once his luck had hung in a leather bag on a thong.
Gone now, he remembered, and the ends of four fingers as well.
But his hands were still long enough to wrap around a woman's throat, he thought, especially a slender throat like hers. Up they went, climbing the turnpike stair in single file. The walls were rough, dark stone, cool to the touch. The light of the torches went before them, and their shadows marched beside them on the walls. At the third turn they passed an iron gate that opened on blackness, and another at the fifth turn. Davis guessed that they were near the surface by then, perhaps even above it. The next door they came to was made of wood, but still they climbed. Now the walls were broken by arrow slits, but no shafts of sunlight pried their way through the thickness of the stone. It was night outside. His legs were aching by the time Sir Axel thrust open a heavy door and gestured him through. Beyond, a high stone bridge arched over emptiness to a massive central tower called the Stone Drum. A sea wind blew restlessly through the arches that supported the roof, and Davis could smell the salt waters they crossed. He took a deep breath, filling his lungs with a clean, cold air.
Wind and water, give me strength,
he prayed. A huge night fire burned in the yard below to keep the terrors of the dark at bay, and the Queen's men were gathered around it, singing praises to their new red god. They were in the center of the bridge when Sir Axel stopped suddenly. He made a brusque gesture with his hand, and his men moved out of earshot.
Were it my choice, I would burn you with my brother Alistair, he told Davis. You are both traitors. Say what you will. I would never betray King Stannis. Oh, you would. You will. I see it in your face, and I have seen it in the flames as well. R'hllor has blessed me with that gift. Like Lady Melisande, he shows me the future in the fire. Stannis Baratheon will sit the Iron Throne. I have seen it, and I know what must be done. His Grace must make me his hand in place of my traitor brother. And you will tell him so.
Will I?
Davis said nothing. The Queen has urged my appointment, Sir Axel went on. Even your old friend from Lice, the Pirate Sarn, he says the same. We have made a plan together, him and me. Yet His Grace does not act. The defeat gnaws inside him, a black worm in his soul. It is up to us who love him to show him what to do. If you are as devoted to his cause as you claim, smuggler, you will join your voice to ours. Tell him that I am the only hand he needs. Tell him, and when we sail, I shall see that you have a new ship.
A ship?
Davis studied the other man's face. Sir Axel had big florent ears, much like the Queen's. Coarse hair grew from them, as from his nostrils. More sprouted in tufts and patches beneath his double chin. His nose was broad, his brow beetled, his eyes close-set and hostile.
He would sooner give me a pyre than a ship. He said as much. But if I do him this favour...
If you think to betray me,
Sir Axel said. "Pray remember that I have been Castellan of Dragonstone a good long time. The garrison is mine. Perhaps I cannot burn you without the king's consent, but who is to say you might not suffer a fall?" He laid a meaty hand on the back of Davis's neck and shoved him bodily against the waist-high side of the bridge, then shoved a little harder to force his face out over the yard. "Do you hear me?"
"I hear," said Davis. "And you dare name me a traitor?"
Sir Axel released him. "Good," he smiled. "His grace awaits. Best we do not keep him." At the very top of Stone Drum, within the great round room called the Chamber of the Painted Table, they found Stannis Baratheon standing behind the artifact that gave the hall its name, a massive slab of wood carved and painted in the shape of Westeros, as it had been in the time of Aegon the Conqueror. An iron brazier stood beside the king, its coals glowing a ruddy orange. Four tall, pointed windows looked out to north, south, east, and west. Beyond was the night and the starry sky. Davis could hear the wind moving, and fainter, the sounds of the sea.
"Your Grace," Sir Axel said, "as it please you, I have brought the Onion Knight."
"So I see." Stannis wore a grey wool tunic, a dark red mantle, and a plain black leather belt from which his sword and dagger hung. A red gold crown with flame-shaped points encircled his brows. The look of him was a shock. He seemed 10 years older than the man that Davis had left at Storm's End when he sailed for the Blackwater and the battle that would be their undoing. The king's close-cropped beard was spider-web with grey hairs, and he had dropped 2 stone or more of weight. He had never been a fleshy man, but now the bones moved beneath his skin like spears, fighting to cut free. Even his crown seemed too large for his head. His eyes were blue pits lost in deep hollows, and the shape of a skull could be seen beneath his face. Yet when he saw Davis, a faint smile brushed his lips. "So the sea has returned me, my knight of the fish and onions."
"It did, Your Grace. Does he know that he had me in his dungeon?"
Davis went to one knee.
"Rise, Sir Davis,"
Stannis commanded. "I've missed you, sir. I have need of good counsel, and you never gave me less. So tell me true. What is the penalty for treason? The word hung in the air.
A frightful word, thought Davis.
Was he being asked to condemn his cellmate? Or himself, perchance?
Kings know the penalty for treason better than any man.
Treason, he finally managed weakly.
What else would you call it, to deny a king and seek to steal his rightful throne? I ask you again, what is the penalty for treason under the law?
Davis had no choice but to answer.
Death, he said. The penalty is death, Your Grace. It has always been so. I am not a cruel man, Sir Davis. You know me, have known me long. This is not my decree. It has always been so, since Aegon's day and before. Daemon Blackfyre, the Brothers Toyne, the Vulture King, Grand Maester Harroth, traitors have always paid with their lives. Even Rhaenyra Targaryen. She was daughter to one king and mother to 2 more, yet she died a traitor's death for trying to usurp her brother's crown. It is law. Law, Davis, not cruelty.
Yes, Your Grace.
He does not speak of me.
Davis felt a moment's pity for his cellmate down in the dark. He knew he should keep silent. But he was tired and sick of heart, and he heard himself say,
"Sire, Lord Florent meant no treason."
"Do smugglers have another name for it? I made him hand, and he would have sold my rights for a bowl of pease porridge. He would even have given them Shireen, mine only child. He would have wed to a bastard born of incest." The king's voice was thick with anger. "My brother had a gift for inspiring loyalty, even in his foes. At Summerhall, he won 3 battles in a single day,
and brought Lords Grandison and Cufferin back to Storm's End as prisoners. He hung their banners in the hall as trophies. Catherine's white fawns were spotted with blood, and Grandison's sleeping lion was torn there in two. Yet they would sit beneath those banners of a night, drinking and feasting with Robert, even took them hunting. These men meant to deliver you to Ares to be burned, I told him, after I saw them throwing axes in the yard. You should not be putting axes in their hands. Robert only laughed. I would have thrown Grandison and Catherine into a dungeon, but he turned them into friends. Lord Catherine died at Ashford Castle, cut down by Randall Tarley, whilst fighting for Robert. Lord Grandison was wounded on the Trident, and died of it a year after. My brother made them love him, but it would seem that I inspire only betrayal, even in my own blood and kin, brother, grandfather, cousins, good uncle.
Your Grace, said Sir Axel, I beg you, give me the chance to prove to you that not all Florence are so feeble.
Sir Axel would have me resume the war, King Stannis told Davos. The Lannisters think I am done and beaten, and my sworn lords have forsaken me near every one. Even Lord Estamont, my own mother's father, has bent his knee to Joffrey. The few loyal men who remain to me are losing heart. They waste their days drinking and gambling, and lick their wounds like beaten curs.
Battle will set their hearts ablaze once more, Your Grace, Sir Axel said. Defeat is a disease, and victory is a cure.
Victory? The king's mouth twisted. There are victories and victories, sir. But tell your plan to Sir Davis. I would hear his views on what you propose.
Sir Axel turned to Davos with a look on his face, much like the look that proud Lord Belgrave must have worn, the day King Balor the Blessed had commanded him to wash the beggar's ulcerous feet. Nonetheless, he obeyed. The plan Sir Axel had devised with Salador San was simple. A few hours' sail from Dragonstone lay Claw Isle, ancient sea-girt seat of House Celtigar. Lord Adrian Celtigar had fought beneath the fiery heart on the Black Water, but once taken, he had wasted no time in going over to Joffrey. He remained in King's Landing even now,
too frightened of his Grace's wrath to come near Dragonstone, no doubt, Sir Axel declared, and wisely so. The man has betrayed his rightful king.
Sir Axel proposed to use Salador San's fleet and the men who had escaped the Blackwater. Stannis still had some 1,500 on Dragonstone, more than half of them Florence, to exact retribution for Lord Celtigar's defection. Claw Isle was but lightly garrisoned, its castle reputedly stuffed with Moorish carpets, Volantine glass, gold and silver plate, jeweled cups, magnificent hawks, an axe of Valyrian steel, a horn that could summon monsters from the deep, chests of rubies, and more wines than a man could drink in 100 years. Though Celtigar had shown the world a niggardly face, he had never stinted on his own comforts.
Put his castle to the torch, and his people to the sword, I say, Sir Axel concluded. Leave Claw Isle, a desolation of ash and bone, fit only for carrion crows, so the realm might see the fate of those who bed with Lannisters.
Stannis listened to Sir Axel's recitation in silence, grinding his jaw slowly from side to side. When it was done, he said,
It could be done, I believe. The risk is small. Joffrey has no strength at sea until Lord Redwine sets sail from the harbour. The plunder might serve to keep the Lycian pirate Salador San loyal for a time. By itself, Claw Isle is worthless. But its fall would serve notice to Lord Tywin that my cause is not yet done.
The king turned back to Davos.
Speak truly, sir. What do you make of Sir Axel's proposal?
Speak truly, sir.
Davos remembered the dark cell he had shared with Lord Alistair, remembered Lamprey and Porridge. He thought of the promises that Sir Axel had made on the bridge above the yard.
A ship or a shove? Ha! What shall it be?
But this was Stannis asking.
Your Grace, he said slowly, I make it folly, I, and cowardice.
Cowardice?
Sir Axel all but shouted. No man calls me craven before my king.
Silence,
Stannis commanded.
Sir Davos, speak on. I would hear your reasons.
Davos turned to face Sir Axel.
You say we ought to show the realm we are not done. Strike a blow. Make war, aye. But on what enemy? You will find no Lannisters on Claw Isle.
We will find traitors, said Sir Axel. Though it may be I could find some closer to home, even in this very room.
Davos ignored the jibe.
I don't doubt Lord Celtigar bent the knee to the boy Joffrey. He's an old done man who wants no more than to end his days in his castle, drinking his fine wine out of his jewel cups.
He turned back to Stannis.
Yet he came when you called, sire. Came with his ships and swords. He stood by you at Storm's End when Lord Renly came down on us, and his ships sailed up the Blackwater. His men fought for you, killed for you, burned for you. Claw Isle is weakly held, yes. Held by women and children and old men. And why is that? Because their husbands and sons and fathers died on the Blackwater. That's why. Died at their oars, or with swords in their hands, fighting beneath our banners. Yet Sir Axel proposes we swoop down on the homes they left behind to rape their widows and put their children to the sword. These small folk are no traitors.
They are,
insisted Sir Axel.
Not all of Celtigar's men were slain on the Blackwater. Hundreds were taken with their lord and bent the knee when he did.
When he did,
Davos repeated.
They were his men, his sworn men. What choice were they given?
Every man has choices. They might have refused to kneel. Some did, and died for it. Yet they died true men and loyal.
Some men are stronger than others.
It was a feeble answer, and Davos knew it. Stannis Baratheon was a man of iron will, who neither understood nor forgave weakness in others.
I am losing,
he thought, despairing.
It is every man's duty to remain loyal to his rightful king, even if the lord he serves proves false,
Stannis declared in a tone that brooked no argument. A desperate folly took hold of Davos, a recklessness akin to madness.
As you remain loyal to King Aerys when your brother raised his banners,
he blurted. Shocked silence followed, until Sir Axel cried,
Treason!
And snatched his dagger from his sheath.
Your Grace, he speaks his infamy to your face.
Davos could hear Stannis grinding his teeth. A vein bulged blue and swollen in the king's brow. Their eyes met.
Put up your knife, Sir Axel, and leave us.
As it please, Your Grace,
it will please me for you to leave, said Stannis. Take yourself from my presence, and send me Melisandre.
As you command.
Sir Axel slid the knife away, bowed, and hurried toward the door. His boots rang against the floor, angry.
You've always presumed on my forbearance, Stannis warned Davos when they were alone. I can shorten your tongue as easily as I did your fingers, smuggler.
I am your man, Your Grace, so it is your tongue to do with as you please.
It is, he said calmer. And I would have it speak the truth, though the truth is a bitter draught at times.
Aerys, if you only knew, that was a hard choosing. My blood or my liege, my brother or my king.
He grimaced.
Have you ever seen the Iron Throne? The barbs along the back, the ribbons of twisted steel, the jagged ends of swords and knives all tangled up and melted?
It is not a comfortable seat, sir.
Aerys cut himself so often, men took to calling him King Scab,
and Maegor the Cruel was murdered in that chair, by that chair, to hear some tell it. It is not a seat where a man can rest at ease. Oft times I wonder why my brothers wanted it so desperately.
Why would you want it, then?
Davos asked him. It is not a question of wanting. The throne is mine as Robert's heir. That is law. After me it must pass to my daughter, unless Selyse should finally give me a son.
He ran three fingers lightly down the table, over the layers of smooth, hard varnish, dark with age.
I am king. Once do not enter into it. I have a duty to my daughter, to the realm, even to Robert. He loved me but little, I know, yet he was my brother. The Lannister woman gave him horns and made a motley fool of him. She may have murdered him as well, as she murdered John Arryn and Ned Stark. For such crimes there must be justice, starting with Cersei and her abominations, but only starting. I mean to scour the court clean, as Robert should have done after the Trident.
Sir Barristan once told me that the rot in King Aerys' reign began with Varys. The eunuch should have never been pardoned, no more than the Kingslayer. At the least, Robert should have stripped the white cloak from Jaime and sent him to the wall, as Lord Stark urged. He listened to John Arryn instead. I was still at Storm's End, under siege and unconsulted. He turned abruptly to give Davos a hard, shrewd look.
The truth now. Why did you wish to murder Lady Melisande?
So he does know.
Davos could not lie to him.
Four of my sons burned on the Blackwater. She gave them to the flames.
You wrong her.
Those fires were no work of hers. Curse the imp. Curse the pyromancers. Curse that fool of Florent, who sailed my fleet into the jaws of a trap. Or curse me, for my stubborn pride, for sending her away when I needed her most. But not Melisande. She remains my faithful servant.
Maester Cresson was your faithful servant. She slew him, as she killed Sir Courtney Penrose and your brother Renly.
Now you sound a fool, the king complained. She saw Renly's end in the flames, yes, but she had no more part in it than I did. The priestess was with me. Your Devon will tell you so. Ask him, if you doubt me. She would have spared Renly if she could. It was Melisande who urged me to meet with him, and give him one last chance to amend his treason. It was Melisande who told me to send for you when Sir Axel wished to give you to R'hllor.
He smiled thinly. Does that surprise you?
Yes. She knows I am no friend to her, or her Red God.
But you are a friend to me. She knows that as well.
He beckoned Davos closer.
The boy is sick. Maester Pylos has been leeching him.
The boy?
His thoughts went to his Devon, the king's squire.
My son, sir?
Devon? Oh, a good boy. He has much of you in him. It is Robert's bastard who is sick, the boy we took at Storm's End.
Adric Storm.
I spoke with him in Aegon's garden. As she wished, as she saw.
Stannis sighed.
Did the boy charm you?
He has that gift. He got it from his father, with the blood. He knows he is a king's son, but chooses to forget that he is bastard-born, and he worships Robert, as Renly did when he was young. My royal brother played the fond father on his visits to Storm's End, and there were gifts, swords and ponies and fur-trimmed cloaks. The eunuchs work, every one. The boy would write the Red Keep full of thanks, and Robert would laugh and ask Varys what he had sent this year. Renly was no better. He left the boy's upbringing to castellans and maesters, and every one fell victim to his charm. Penrose chose to die rather than give him up. The king ground his teeth together.
It still angers me. How could he think I would hurt the boy? I chose Robert, did I not? When that hard day came, I chose blood over honour. He does not use the boy's name.
That made Davos very uneasy.
I hope young Edric will recover soon.
Stannis waved a hand, dismissing his concern.
It is a chill, no more. He coughs, he shivers, he has a fever. Maester Pylos will soon set him right. By himself the boy is naught, you understand? But in his veins flows my brother's blood. There is power in a king's blood, she says.
Davis did not have to ask who she was. Stannis touched the painted table.
Look at it, Onion Knight. My realm, by rights, my Westeros. He swept a hand across it. This talk of seven kingdoms is a folly. Aegon saw that 300 years ago when he stood where we are standing. They painted this table at his command. Rivers and bays they painted, hills and mountains, castles and cities and market towns, lakes and swamps and forests, but no borders. It is all one. One realm, for one king to rule alone.
One king, agreed Davos. One king means peace.
I shall bring justice to Westeros, a thing Sir Axel understands as little as he does war. Claw Isle would gain me naught, and it was evil, just as you said. Celtigar must pay the traitor's price himself in his own person, and when I come into my kingdom he shall. Every man shall reap what he has sown, from the highest lord to the lowest gutter rat. And some will lose more than the tips off their fingers, I promise you. They have made my kingdom bleed, and I do not forget that.
King Stannis turned from the table.
On your knees, Onion Knight.
Your grace?
For your onions and fish, I made you a knight once. For this, I am of a mind to raise you to lord.
This? Davos was lost. I am content to be your knight, your grace. I would not know how to begin being lordly.
Good. To be lordly is to be false. I've learned that lesson hard. Now kneel. Your king commands.
Davos knelt, and Stannis drew his longsword. Lightbringer, Melisandre had named it. The red sword of heroes, drawn from the fires where the seven guards were consumed. The room seemed to grow brighter as the blade slid from its scabbard. The steel had a glow to it, now orange, now yellow, now red. The air shimmered around it, and no jewel had ever sparkled so brilliantly. But when Stannis touched it to Davos's shoulder, it felt no different than any other longsword.
"Sir Davos of House Seaworth," the king said, "are you my true and honest liegeman now and forever?"
"I am, your grace."
"And do you swear to serve me loyally all your days, to give me honest counsel and swift obedience, to defend my rights and my realm against all foes in battles great and small, to protect my people and punish my enemies?"
"I do, your grace."
"Then rise again, Davos Seaworth, and rise as Lord of the Rainwood, Admiral of the Narrow Sea, and Hand of the King."
For a moment, Davos was too stunned to move.
"I woke this morning in his dungeon."
"Your grace, you cannot. I am no fit man to be a king's hand."
"There is no man fitter."
Davos sheathed Lightbringer, gave Davos his hand, and pulled him to his feet.
"I am low-born," Davos reminded him. "An up-jump smuggler. Your lords will never obey me.
Then we will make new lords."
"But I cannot read, nor write."
"Maester Pylos can read for you. As to writing, my last hand wrote the head off his shoulders. All I ask of you are the things you've always given me. Honesty, loyalty, service."
"Surely there's someone better, some great lord."
Stannis snorted.
"Bar Eamon, that boy, my faithless grandfather. Celtigar has abandoned me. The new Valyrian is 6 years old, and the new Sunglass sailed for Volantis after I burned his brother."
He made an angry gesture.
"A few good men remain, it's true. Sir Gilbert Faring holds Storm's End for me still, with 200 loyal men. Lord Morrigan, the bastard of Nightsong, young Chittering, my cousin Andrew. But I trust none of them, as I trust you, my Lord of Rainwood. You will be my hand. It is you I want beside me for the battle. Another battle will be the end of all of us, thought Davos. Lord Alistair saw that much true enough.
Your Grace asked for honest counsel. In honesty, then, we lack the strength for another battle against the Lannisters.
It is a great battle His Grace is speaking of, said a woman's voice, rich with the accents of the East. Melisande stood at the door, in her red silks and shimmering satins, holding a covered silver dish in her hands. These little wars are no more than the scuffle of children before what is to come. The one whose name may not be spoken is marshalling his power, Davos Seaworth, a power fell and evil and strong beyond measure. Soon comes the cold and the night that never ends. She placed a silver dish on the painted table. Unless true men find the courage to fight it, men whose hearts are fire. Stannis stared at the silver dish.
She has shown it to me, Lord Davos, in the flames.
You saw it, sire?
It was not like Stannis Baratheon to lie about such a thing. With mine own eyes. After the battle, when I was lost to despair, the Lady Melisande bid me gaze into the hearth fire. The chimney was drawing strongly, and bits of ash were rising from the fire. I stared at them, feeling half a fool, but she bid me look deeper, and the ashes were white, rising in the updraft. Yet all at once it seemed as if they were falling. Snow, I thought. Then the sparks in the air seemed to circle, to become a ring of torches, and I was looking through the fire, down on some high hill in a forest. The cinders had become men in black behind the torches, and there were shapes moving through the snow. For all the heat of the fire, I felt a cold, so terrible I shivered. But when I did, the sight was gone. The fire, but a fire once again. But what I saw was real. I'd stake my kingdom on it.
And have, said Melisande.
The conviction in the king's voice frightened Davos to the core.
A hill in a forest? Shapes in the snow? I don't.
It means that the battle is begun, said Melisande. The sand is running through the glass more quickly now, and man's hour on earth is almost done. We must act boldly, or all hope is lost. Westeros must unite beneath her one true king, the prince that was promised, Lord of Dragonstone, and chosen of R'hllor.
R'hllor chooses queerly, then, the king grimaced, as if he'd tasted something foul. Why me, and not my brothers? Renly and his peach. In my dreams I could see the juice running from his mouth, the blood from his throat. If he had done his duty by his brother, we would have smashed Lord Tywin. A victory even Robert could be proud of. Robert! His teeth ground side to side. He's in my dreams as well, laughing, drinking, boasting. Those were the things he was best at. Those, and fighting. I never bested him at anything. The Lord of Light should have made Robert his champion. Why me?
Because you are a righteous man, said Melisande.
A righteous man. Stannis touched the covered silver platter with a finger. With leeches.
Yes, said Melisande. But I must tell you once more, this is not the way.
You swore it would work. The king looked angry.
It will, and it will not.
Which?
Both.
Speak sense to me, woman.
When the fire speak more plainly, so shall I. There is truth in the flames, but is not always easy to see.
The great red ruby at her throat
drank fire from the glow of the brazier.
"Give me the boy, Your Grace. It is the surer way, the better way. Give me the boy, and I shall wake the stone dragon."
"I've told you, no."
"He is only one base-born boy, against all the boys of Westeros, and all the girls as well, against all the children that might ever be born in all the kingdoms of the world.
The boy is innocent."
"The boy defiled your marriage bed, else you would surely have sons of your own. He shamed you."
"Robert did that, not the boy. My daughter's grown fond of him, and he's mine own blood."
"Your brother's blood,"
Melisande said.
"A king's blood. Only a king's blood can wake the stone dragon."
Stannis ground his teeth. "I'll hear no more of this. The dragons are done. The Targaryens tried to bring them back half a dozen times and made fools of themselves, all corpses. Patchface is the only fool we need on this godforsaken rock. You have the leeches. Do your work."
Melisande bowed her head stiffly and said, "As my king commands."
Reaching up her left sleeve with her right hand, she flung a handful of powder into the brazier. The coals roared. As pale flames writhed atop them, the Red Woman retrieved the silver dish and brought it to the king. Davos watched her lift the lid. Beneath were three large black leeches, fat with blood.
"The boy's blood," Davos knew. "A king's blood."
Stannis stretched forth a hand, and his fingers closed around one of the leeches.
"Say the name,"
Melisande commanded. The leech was twisting in the king's grip, trying to attach itself to one of his fingers. "The usurper," he said, "Joffrey Baratheon." When he tossed the leech into the fire, it curled up like an autumn leaf amidst the coals and burned. Stannis grasped the second. "The usurper," he declared, louder this time. "Balon Greyjoy." He flipped it lightly onto the brazier, and its flesh spit and cracked. The blood burst from it, hissing and smoking. The last was in the king's hand. This one he studied a moment as it writhed between his fingers. "The usurper," he said at last, "Robb Stark." And he threw it on the flames.
Tyrion. Varys stood over the brazier, warming his soft hands.
"It would appear Renly was murdered most fearfully in the very midst of his army. His throat was open from ear to ear by a blade that passed through steel and bone as if they were soft cheese."
"Murdered by whose hand?" Cersei demanded.
"Have you ever considered that too many answers are the same as no answers at all? My informers are not always as highly placed as we might like. When a king dies, fancies sprout like mushrooms in the dark. A groom says that Renly was slain by a knight of his own rainbow guard. A washerwoman claims Stannis stole through the heart of his brother's army with his magic sword. Several men-at-arms believe a woman did the fell deed, but cannot agree on which woman. A maid that Renly had spurned claims one. A camp follower brought in to serve his pleasure on the eve of battle says a second. The third ventures that it might have been the Lady Catelyn Stark."
The queen was not pleased.
"Must you waste our time with every rumour the fools care to tell?"
"You pay me well for these rumours, my gracious queen."
"We pay you for the truth, Lord Varys. Remember that, or this small council may grow smaller still."
Varys tittered nervously. "You and your noble brother will leave his grace with no council at all if you continue."
I dare say the realm could survive a few less counsellors, said Littlefinger with a smile.
Dear, dear Ptah, said Varys, are you not concerned that yours might be the very next name on the hand's little list?
Before you, Varys, I should never dream of it.
Mayhaps we will be brothers on the wall together, you and I.
Varys giggled again. Sooner than you'd like, if the next words out of your mouth are not something useful, eunuch. From the look in her eyes, Cersei was prepared to castrate Varys all over again.
Might this be some ruse? Asked Littlefinger. If so, it is a ruse of surpassing cleverness, said Varys. It has certainly hoodwinked me.
Tyrion had heard enough.
Joff will be so disappointed, he said. He was saving such a nice spike for Renly's head. But whoever did the deed, we must assume that Stannis was behind it. The gain is clearly his.
He did not like the news. He had counted on the brothers Baratheon decimating each other in bloody battle. He could feel his elbow throbbing where the Morning Star had laid it open. It did that sometimes in the damp. He squeezed it uselessly in his hand and asked,
"What of Renly's host?"
"The greater part of his foot remains at Bitterbridge." Varys abandoned the brazier to take his seat at the table. "Most of the lords who rode with Lord Renly to Storm's End have gone over banner and blade to Stannis with all their chivalry."
"Led by the Florence, I'll wager," said Littlefinger. Varys gave him a simpering smile.
"You would win, my lord. Lord Aelstor was indeed the first to bend the knee. Many others followed."
"Many," Tyrion said pointedly. "But not all?"
"Not all," agreed the eunuch. "Not Loras Tyrell, nor Randall Tarly, nor Mathys Rowan. And Storm's End itself has not yielded. Sir Courtenay Penrose holds the castle in Renly's name, and will not believe his liege is dead. He demands to see the mortal remains before he opens his gates. But it seems that Renly's corpse has unaccountably vanished, carried away, most likely. A fifth of Renly's knights departed with Sir Loras rather than bend the knee to Stannis. It said the Knight of Flowers went mad when he saw his king's body and slew three of Renly's guards in his wrath, among them Eamon Kai and Robert Royce.
A pity is stopped at three, thought Tyrion.
Sir Loras is likely making for Bitterbridge, Varys went on. His sister is there, Renly's queen, as well as a great many soldiers who suddenly find themselves kingless. Which side will they take now? A ticklish question. Many serve the lords who remained at Storm's End, and those lords now belong to Stannis.
Tyrion leaned forward.
There is a chance here, it seems to me. Win Loras Tyrell to our cause, and Lord Mace Tyrell and his bannermen might join us as well. They may have sworn their swords to Stannis for the moment, yet they cannot love the man, or they would have been his from the start.
Is their love for us any greater? Asked Cersei.
Scarcely, said Tyrion. They love Renly, clearly, but Renly is slain. Perhaps we can give them good and sufficient reasons to prefer Joffrey to Stannis, if we move quickly.
What sort of reasons do you mean to give them?
Gold reasons,
Littlefinger suggested at once. Varys made a tisking sound.
Sweet Ptah, surely you do not mean to suggest that these puissant lords and noble knights could be bought like so many chickens in the market.
Have you been to our markets of late, Lord Varys? Asked Littlefinger.
You would find it easier to buy a lord than a chicken, I dare say.
Of course, lords cluck prouder than chickens, and take it ill if you offer them coin like a tradesman, but they are seldom adverse to taking gifts, honours, lands, castles.
"Bribes may sway some of the lesser lords," Tyrion said, "but never I, Garden."
"True," Littlefinger admitted. "The Knight of Flowers is the key there. Mace Tyrell has two elder sons, but Loras has always been his favourite. Win him, and Highgarden will be yours."
"Yes," thought Tyrion. "It seems to me that we should take a lesson from the late Lord Renly. We can win the Tyrell alliance, as he did, with a marriage."
Varys understood the quickest. "You think to wed King Joffrey to Margaery Tyrell?"
"I do."
Renly's young queen was no more than 15, 16, he seemed to recall. Older than Joffrey, but a few years were nothing. It was so neat and sweet he could taste it.
"Joffrey is betrothed to Sansa Stark," Cersei objected. "Marriage contracts can be broken. What advantage is there in wedding the king to the daughter of a dead traitor?"
Littlefinger spoke up. "You might point out to his grace that the Tyrells are much wealthier than the Starks, and that Margaery is said to be lovely, and beddable besides."
"Yes," said Tyrion, "Joff ought to like that well enough."
"My son is too young to care about such things."
"You think so?" asked Tyrion. "He's 13, Cersei, the same age at which I married."
"You shamed us all with that sorry episode. Joffrey is made of finer stuff."
"So fine that he had Sir Boris rip off Sansa's gown."
"He was angry with the girl."
"He was angry with that cook's boy who spilled the soup last night as well. But he didn't strip him naked."
"This was not a matter of some spilled soup."
"No, it was a matter of some pretty tits."
After that business in the yard, Tyrion had spoken with Varys about how they might arrange for Joffrey to visit Shataya's. A taste of honey might sweeten the boy, he hoped. He might even be grateful, gods forbid, and Tyrion could do with a shade more gratitude from his sovereign. It would need to be done secretly, of course. The tricky bit would be parting him from the hound.
"The dog is never far from his master's heels," he observed to Varys, "but all men sleep, and some gamble, and whore, and visit wine sinks as well."
"The hound does all these things, if that is your question."
"No," said Tyrion. "My question is, when?"
Varys had laid a finger on his cheek, smiling enigmatically.
"My lord, a suspicious man might think you wish to find a time when Sandor Clegane was not protecting King Joffrey, the better to do the boy some harm."
"Surely you know me better than that, Lord Varys," Tyrion said. "Why, all I want is for Joffrey to love me."
The eunuch had promised to look into the matter. The war made its own demands, though. Joffrey's initiation into manhood would need to wait.
"Doubtless you know your son better than I do," he made himself tell Cersei. "But regardless, there's still much to be said for a Tyrell marriage. It may be the only way that Joffrey lives long enough to reach his wedding night."
Littlefinger agreed. "The Stark girl brings Joffrey nothing but her body, sweet as that may be. Margaery Tyrell brings 50,000 swords and all the strength of Highgarden."
"Indeed," Varys laid a soft hand on the queen's sleeve. "You have a mother's heart, and I know his grace loves his little sweetling. Yet kings must learn to put the needs of the realm before their own desires. I say this offer must be made."
The queen pulled free of the eunuch's touch. "You would not speak so if you were women. Say what you will, my lords, but Joffrey is too proud to settle for Renly's leavings. He will never consent." Tyrion shrugged.
When the king comes of age in 3 years, he may give or withhold his consent as he pleases. Until then, you are his regent, and I am his hand, and he will marry whomever we tell him.